Succession number 26809, Reel 3.
A Prisoner of War Remembers by Cyril Hammersma. I was called up in October 1939, the first of the conscripts, and the newspapers called us the Belisha Boys, after the Right Honourable Hall Belisha, who was then the War Minister. I was drafted and drilled at Boyce Barracks in Crookham in Hampshire, in the RAMC, the Royal Army Medical Corps. The most vivid memories I have are of my feet, or rather my blistered feet. Army boots didn't take kindly at all. I was weary with all the marching and jumping and exercises and humping casualties, the casualties being our comrades. You see, everyone had a turn at playing casualty, and we each had to carry our comrade, fireman's lift, as in collection from the field of battle, to the accompaniment of our drill sergeant's shouted instructions. Eventually, I was posted to Oxford and billeted in one of the colleges, which was delightful. The beauty of the town and colleges, the pubs and the blackout, all led to the excitement of new experiences, especially making dates in the blackout. We did have some frights when we got the girls into the pubs. I drew portraits of soldiers and some nursing sisters, and we were in the process of forming the 26th General Hospital. These are some of the watercolours I painted in Oxford, which then abounded in quaint lanes and soaring spires. The hospital padre noticed I was decorating ward screens like these with Venetian scenes, and when he saw the extent of my work, he thought up a scheme for me to show my paintings in the Oxford gas showroom, all in aid of comforts for the patients, balaclavas and socks and things like that. He was a wonderful man at twisting arms and getting everyone to help, and nobody could resist him, and of course the cause was so worthy. This is the poster for my first exhibition. It was very well supported, and in this photo, which was in the Oxford Mail, the Mayor of Oxford and my commanding officer listen while I tell them all about the paintings. Some months later, we embarked on the old Queen Mary and sailed from Gourock in Scotland in convoy with the Berengaria and Mauritania, all Cunard Line luxury ships long since broken up. I was so seasick all the way to Egypt, changing boats in Ceylon and Bombay, and the ships were getting smaller and smaller all the time. I did make a hurried sketch as we waited for the ferry to cross the Suez Canal. En route by train, we stopped in Cairo for 2 days, and I wasn't going to let this great opportunity slip by without seeing the pyramids. Two of my friends and I took a taxi to see these wonders, and with a guide we explored all the inner chambers and galleries. It was a wonderful and unforgettable experience. These hurried sketches of the Sphinx and the pyramids were made fighting off flies and Arabs begging us to go for a camel ride. Of course their trade, the Arabs, had collapsed, and the flies had a thin time since the tourists were non-existent. Finally, after months of waiting, the Sarapan transport camp, we set off for Greece on active service, where the Greeks were fighting off the Albanians. We were bombed in Alexandria Harbour by Italian planes, but fortunately for us, packed like sardines on a Dutch cargo boat, the bombs fell all around. In a few days we were unloading stores in Piraeus Harbour and speeding through the Athens streets, packed with cheering, clapping Athenians, jumping for joy that the British had come to help them. I made some notes on a bucking lorry as we sped through Athens, and it bounced and careered past the famous Acropolis and Parthenon. These notes give you some idea what they were like. Trying to find my way round Athens made me realise the truth in the saying, "It's all Greek to me." And still there was the blackout, with all its interesting adventures, but language makes no difference at all when it comes to contacting nice friendly girls. There's all sorts of languages. The Greek government had requisitioned 3 big tourist hotels in a small village called Kephissia, at the foot of a large mountain called Mount Pentelikon. It was winter when we arrived, but the customs and the architecture, stark white against the deepest green of the cypress trees, enthralled me. I was soon filling my sketchbooks. I did most of this off duty, always carrying a notebook with me. Our first casualty and the first department operating was the dentist. He was always very proud of that. Of course, we weren't very busy in the wards then. Most of our patients had sandfly fever, which is dysentery. Later on, we were to take the worst of the Greek casualties from the Albanian front, and then we began to realise what war was all about. The Greek ambulances brought them in the most pitiful state, frostbitten amputees, guillotined on the field, gaunt and unwashed and unshaven, with black eyes staring at us in bewilderment and disbelief as we tried to alleviate their suffering, not to mention the huge task of delousing them first. I had quite a task, changing all our ward directions into Greek and trying to find our young Greek interpreter to provide the equivalent words. Confusion was everywhere, English and Greek. The Greek soldiers' clothes were all burnt, of course. I was a nursing orderly with a ward of 50 sandfly fever casualties, all in hotel rooms with 3 or 4 beds jammed tight. Round the corner, in another part of the corridor, were the Greek soldiers constantly calling out and moaning, "Ponai, ponai," which means pain. Their custom was to have the whole family and distant relatives to sit on the floor round the patient's bed. They all were moaning, of course. The language barrier, as you can imagine, was acute, apart from the treatment and feeding. The relatives wanted feeding too. And when the patient wanted a bedpan, well, that was passed round the family too. Some of these sketches are very telling, and the grouping of the figures round the bed and patient made an indelible image in my mind. During this time, my friends and I used to frequent a cafe on the road that led to the mountain. There were always Greek peasants to have a glass of wine with. I was surrounded with characters. We used to have, I remember, pea omelettes, and I'd be observing all the people eating there and drinking. One night this old man was sitting at a nearby table. I had my watercolours, so I bought him some wine, showed him my paper and paint, and with signs he agreed, I think, to sit still while I painted this portrait of him. This was about Christmas of 1940. Several of my friends and I were in Ammonia Square, that is the main square in Athens, on Christmas Eve, when some young Greek students speaking English invited us all to a party in an expensive looking block of flats. We were welcomed with drinks of every kind, smiles and hugs abounded, interspersed with some rather pointed though casual questions. Where were we stationed, and how many men were there, how many patients, and where were they from? Suddenly the lounge doors were open and there was a table laden with Christmas fare. No turkey, though. The custom there in Greece is to have a great fish, a carp, dressed overall with every delicacy imaginable. We all sat down and got stuck in, Arab fashion, while waiters circled the table, filling our glasses. Arab fashion is the eastern way of everyone helping themselves from a large dish in the middle of the table, with their fingers. It is a real free-for-all, and the waiters continually circled the table behind us, filling our glasses with wine. Still the questions came, and stronger the cognac, till we didn't know or care what or who came next, or really what we said. Finally, we staggered our way out from the flat, and despite our protesting hosts escaped from their flattering attentions and probing questions. Back in quarters in Kefisia, the stream of patients grew in volume as more and more reinforcements poured into Greece, as the threat from Germany became more apparent. Winter, with its frostbite and other casualties of the intense cold, subsided, giving way to spring and the joy everywhere of the celebration of Easter and the church's festivities in the village. The procession of the crucifix through the narrow streets and the candles, incense and chants of the priests and people, and the Easter celebration of the resurrection in the church. Everyone was so happy and dancing with joy. Festoons of coloured votive lamps, golden vestments studded with flashing jewels, and the priests in great towering crowns of gold encrusted with glowing precious stones. I stood at the back of the church. It was thick now with the smoke and fumes of the hundreds of huge candles. The chanting and the heat from the candles was overpowering, and the intensity of the gloom overcoming all my human feelings. This experience has never dimmed over all the years. I had given many of my sketches to a major Chartres ophthalmic surgeon, and early spring he asked me if I would go with him to visit a friend of his who was staying in a farmhouse near Menidi, and bring some of my watercolours. We drove out on a bright sunny Sunday afternoon through a field of early corn to an isolated farm. I, clutching my sketches, was introduced to a dignified middle-aged lady who was sitting on a low veranda with four other gentlemen. The Major introduced me to her, then smiling extended his hand, Her Royal Highness Princess Alice. She chatted to me, praising my work, watercolours of Athens, the Parthenon, and earlier sketches of Palestine. An afternoon tea was served, and another friend of the Princess, who was a painter, showed me some of his work. Her Highness was so kind and pleasant, and wished me good luck. I wished I had offered her one of my sketches. Later I discovered that the princess was Prince Philip's mother. She and the royal family were poised to escape the German invasion. Soon everything of Easter was to be shattered, including the normal run-of-the-mill casualties from the Commonwealth troops. On April the 6th, the radio announced German troops had crossed the Greek frontier at three points, and were racing in armoured columns, thrusting everything before them. We knew how our defences were holding before the official news from the BBC. We had radios, of course, in all the wards. Ambulances began to arrive at all hours. Air raids and alerts sounded night and day. Casualties from a trickle became a torrent. Convoys of ambulances from northern Greece, where the British Army was defending the Olympus Pass, arrived at night battered and shot up from Stuka dive bombers, which attacked whenever they moved to daylight. We erected large marquees in the hospital grounds and crammed them with beds. All the hotel corridors were lined each side with stretchers. The days merged with the nights, and we all dwelt in that unreal world of twilight, not knowing whether it was day or night. Bent and straining backs, unloading, moaning, suffering and blooded men. I remember unloading casualties from the Red Cross train and an Athens siding, and burying myself in long grass as we waited at Menidi station for a hospital train, while German junkers flew over us at treetop height, straight from the rising sun, loosing off their machine guns as they attacked Menidi aerodrome. The third week in April, chaos was complete, and we knew from the ambulances that the Germans were at Voulos, only hours away from Athens. The bugle was sounding the alarm at all hours of the day and night as the planes came over on reconnaissance. We were warned to expect German paratroopers at any moment, and were given a password to use when challenging anyone suspicious. A guard was posted during our last week of freedom, and I was one of this guard which patrolled the vicinity of the three hotels at night. It was difficult to maintain one's strength when all day unloading casualties, stretcher bearing to the third or fourth floor, upstairs, nursing in wards, bringing supplies to wards, serving out meals, feeding patients, and then guard duty at night. On the night of the 24th of April, I went on guard at 12 midnight till 2 a.m. So tired, fighting to keep awake, I stumbled into the patient's dining hotel and fell into a dead stupor under a table. I knew nothing until about 7 o'clock when I opened my eyes to see one of our staff wearing a Red Cross armband. I staggered out to the guard room, and there was nobody anywhere. After some time, I learned that the whole unit had searched for me in vain, and one half of our hospital staff had evacuated to Crete to escape the imminent capture by the Germans. Over 46 nursing sisters of the Queen Alexandra Imperial Nursing Service were the last to be evacuated on the 24th of April, 2 days before we were captured. They were airlifted from Farallon Bay by Sunderland flying boats, which had two floats to enable them to land and take off from water. As the sisters were being taken out to the aircraft by boats, they were attacked by German fighter planes. When a gunner on the beach was killed, a sister grabbed the mounted machine gun and continued to maintain fire. I was in charge of reception when a German major and captain drove up to the hotel in an open tourer. The major came up the stairs and said in perfect English, "We admire you very much. You're first class. Take me to your director." And he asked our major in charge for his pistol and couldn't understand when told we don't carry arms. We had to sign a form promising not to escape, but how could we with 500 casualties on stretchers? All nappy stores had been directed to us from every unit, and as the support troops retreated to the east and ships, I had a huge case of Smith's crisps. The hospital and patients were shunted round the suburbs of Athens to an orphanage. As our patients recovered, we were taken to Corinth, to a huge, barren, sandy, ex-Turkey barracks, which enclosed the whole 12,000 British and Commonwealth troops taken prisoner in Greece. Taken there in a Greek coach, we were dumped in front of the centre blockhouse, defended with machine guns. We dug holes for shelter. The nights were bitter, and these protected us from the cold and also from stray bullets that the SS, that's the stormtroopers, trigger-happy troops, would let fly at anything that moved. Everyone had dysentery, and we had to dig 200 yard long trenches, a thin soup, sawdust soup we called it, and a slice of black bread once a day was our staple diet. After some weeks we were sent to the Athens Polytechnic to nurse the casualties from Crete. The Germans were flying in. Some six of our unit escaped, and this was while the Greek girls chatted to the Jerry patrol. They dashed across the street to a Mrs. Costis house. She was the head of the Greek Red Cross. Finally, in November, we were taken to Piraeus to board a ship to take us to Salonika. And to our astonishment, as we were herded into the hold of this boat, we met the other half of our unit that had evacuated to Crete. They had been captured at the fall of Crete and had really had a rough time from bombing and strafing. Going through the Aegean Sea, the prison ship hugged its way all round the coast, past scores of islands and inlets. Any chance of escape was threatened by the guards on deck and the machine guns on the bridge. Sawdust soup followed us with tasteless acorn coffee. In a few days, we berthed at Salonika, marched and staggered through the town to a bug and rat infested ancient barracks to await our transport to Greece. In 2 weeks we were bundled into cattle trucks, 25 to a truck together with other prisoners, some 15 wagons to make the train, and at the end a raised lookout post with machine gun, and in between every other truck a Jerry guard. And we were given 3 tins of Schweinfleisch, which is pork, and half a loaf for our trip to Germany. The double doors were opened one at a time, once a day for 5 minutes in the open country, and surrounded by guards, everybody jumped out. The train rolled on, day one, day two, long interminable days, and nights beginning when daylight went, long stops for hours in sidings. Through a small window, 2 foot by 1 foot, at each end of the cattle truck, covered with barbed wire, we could catch glimpses of the countryside. I vividly remember some peasants bringing little piglets along the road beside the track. This was in Yugoslavia, characters out of a fairy story. The railway ascended as we crawled over the Carpathian Mountains, bitterly cold, then followed the River Danube after leaving Belgrade. This was on the route to Vienna. Here we were given another small tin of pork and a third of a loaf. The nightmare journey was to last another 4 days. We really began to look a scruffy lot. Sometimes we filled tins of drinking water at the sidings. On and on through Yugoslavia, then Zagreb, starting and stopping, being shunted at junctions, at times catching glimpses of the engine in the front and the mounted guard with the machine gun at the rear when the train was going round bends. I made some sketches from the small window, which was our only source of light and outlet for waste. Another 2 days and timed events became a blur. Our food had run out, and the cold nights when we laid out on the floor became merged in with the days. And finally we stopped. We didn't know or care whether we had reached a destination. The train had stopped and started again so many times for 7 days. Sometime later, the shouts of rouse, rouse from the guards all along the train and the rasp of truck doors being opened convinced us that we'd finally arrived. Marching in straggling columns, clutching our few belongings, tins and a blanket, we shambled along bleak open country roads for how long I can't think, till we reached the high barbed wire fences and guard boxes of Stalagate B. We squatted inside the second fence, there were three, and were thoroughly searched with our bits and pieces. We had nothing, so they found nothing. Herded then into the main camp area, we were put in barracks, long huts divided into two, a washhouse in the middle, 100 men in three-tiered bunks on either side. We hadn't eaten for 3 days, but a large metal dustbin of cabbage and fish soup was brought in for us by other prisoners, Kriegis we were now called. The soup was revolting, but we all gulped it down, but our stomachs rebelled with the usual reaction. November now, and life in camp began by everyone being scalped and deloused and herded into large shower rooms. The water's temperature was unregulated. Being medical personnel, our duties in the camp were under sanitation, but mostly we were sent outside the camp to gather potatoes from the winter clamps. The normal practice was to hide as many potatoes, they were for the camp soup kitchens, as one could handle, and walk straight in trouser legs, blouses, and in the cap or balaclava. But as soon as we were inside the second fence, everyone was searched one by one. If we got away with one or two potatoes, we were lucky. We lined up in front of 2 guards in single file, stepped forward, arms held high, hats were whipped off, potatoes flew in all directions as they tumbled out onto the floor from our uniforms. Red Cross parcels were getting through to us, but only intermittently. And when they came, it was wonderful to have some normal food. And the boxes were divided between 3 men, and all tins were punctured at the distribution at one end of the barrack room by a jerry guard with his jackknife to prevent hoarding of food for a possible escape. Even so, many tins were smuggled through by distracting the guard and slipping one past him. Christmas came, and Christmas Red Cross parcels gave us the extra bit of cheer, plum pudding and tin steak with macaroni and English tea. Camp concerts of music and shows of all kinds were staged in barrack rooms. 3 padres, the RC, CV and the Free Church, all had their services. One barrack room was used as a church, the other a camp school. Ex-teachers and anyone with the knowledge gave classes in everything from accounting, maths, English literature, and I gave lessons in life drawing and landscape. Stalagate B was, for the first 2 years, consisted of men captured from France and Dunkirk in 1940 and with us from the Greek debacle. In October 1942, we welcomed the prisoners Rommel had taken in the desert. They were in very poor shape, with only their tropical uniform, and the Silesian winter was soon biting hard. Everyone shared clothes and somehow smuggled rations which helped them. A favourite pastime was practised by the Australian Kriegis. They held sessions of 2-up, played with 2 pennies, which were flung up in the air. Everyone betted on the 2 heads or tails when they landed. These games were in the top Aussie, that's the Australian compound, along with the market where items and Red Cross food was bartered or swapped. The camp currency was cigarettes, which were issued at 25 each a week, but after the Canadian prisoners who were captured at their disastrous raid on Dieppe arrived, the value dropped because the Canadian parcels of 5,000 cigarettes each soon swamped the market. The Germans claimed the Canadians had tied their prisoners' hands behind them, so they tied the Canadians and Air Force prisoners in our camp as a reprisal. They were tied with Red Cross parcel string at 8 a.m. till 6 p.m. every day. This went on for months until the Germans found they were tying up all day long. They discovered that as each prisoner was tied, he went out, was untied by us, and joined the line waiting to be tied. Some Red Cross supplies also included paints and brushes, and the camp RSM, who gave me some to paint our many portraits of fellow Kriegers, camp life and activities like the barrack room, brew up, hot water boiled in the washroom, lining up with tea leaves in the Dixie, and football matches. Later I copied the RSM's daughter's wedding photo which he'd just received. Our relatives could send us clothing or cigarettes, parcels, and we got socks, pullovers and balaclava helmets. It was so bitterly cold and our straw palliasses and bedboards in the three-tiered bunks were very hard. My friend John, who was the camp Dolmetscher interpreter, got us some German newspapers to put